Hey, it's Doug here, and I wanted to pop in before I send it to the episode with Frank. And I'm supposed to tell stories, so I do have some story time. I have a tip for you today. So this one's actually helpful, because most of the time, I'm just telling some story. But I do like to have print books, and I will spend money on books. But I do have the frugal gene that many of us have. And the thing is, I know that there's a lot of used books out there. And what I've started to do is hop over to eBay and I'll just take a quick look, see if the book that I'm looking for is available. I think like 99% of the time, I can't even think of a time when the book has not been available. And I was chatting with Carl the other day and we were texting back and forth because I read the Duff McKagan book, the autobiography. He's the bassist for Guns N' Roses and he played in Velvet Revolver and has his own solo stuff as well. But people know him from Guns N' Roses. And Carl loves Guns N' Roses. I was a huge fan. I'm a little bit younger, a lot younger than Carl. So I was in elementary school when Guns N' Roses were blowing up, but I still like them very much. In fact, I had a t-shirt, like the Guns N' Roses logo. I think I got it from like Spencer's Gifts, or it turned to Hot Topic later. But anyway, I like GNR quite a bit. Carl was telling me that he was reading the Slash book, which I am holding, because I hopped over to eBay and I was like, I'll see if they have one available. I bet they do. And sure enough, I got the hardback. I sprang for the hardback. Thing is, you could find used books over on eBay for usually like $4 to $5, and even the hardback sometimes for about $5. Typically, the shipping is free. The shipping is actually free. And there are a couple brands on there, a couple sellers on eBay that basically if you buy three, they'll give you the fourth one free. So I purchased several books. I'll get like four books for $16, basically. And again, it's free shipping. Typically these books, I'm not 100% sure, but most of the time I think they're donated to like a Goodwill or something like that. And then a lot of times, like I think one of the sellers is from Goodwill. So I also got this Spooky in Yellowstone, which I think I referenced when I was chatting with Chris Russin, Tales of Hauntings and Strange Happenings, Another Local Lore. It's just fun. It's a little fun. I've seen it in the gift shop. So I'm heading to Yellowstone soon. You know, this just gets me in the spirit. The other thing is I know there's some stories for Old Faithful Inn. That's like the giant log cabin in there. Look it up if you haven't like watched a documentary or you don't know what I'm talking about. But we're staying like in the old part of the inn, which is supposed to be very haunted. Disclaimer again, I don't believe in ghosts. I just like the history. I like the stories, but I don't believe in ghosts. Then the other one here, Death in Yellowstone. And I think Chris mentioned that he actually read this one. I've heard a couple of the stories. This is pretty thick. This one is about 400 pages, which, crazy enough, going back to the Slash book, this is over 400 pages, I think. I mean, he has a lot of stories to tell. Yeah, 455. I would not have guessed that this was so long. There's a few pictures in here, but not a ton. Anyway, that's the tip for today. Get used books. If you like print books, go to eBay. There's a strong chance you could find whatever book that you're looking for like $4, and it's probably free shipping. And they're typically in, like, this is in pristine condition. It doesn't look like anyone ever opened it or read it, because let's face it, a lot of people don't read. So I think, yeah, these two Yellowstone books, I don't think anyone read it. It looks like someone had this Slash book in their backpack or something for a little while. It looks a little beat up. You know, it doesn't look like anyone read it. It just looks like it was in someone's bag and got jostled around in their car or something like that. I don't know. The other thing I'll let you know, if you want to support the show, you can do that in a couple of ways. I have a store set up. You can get t-shirts. You get the airplane t-shirt. You can get the asparagus stuff. There's products that I recommend. So products that I actually use, like maybe razors that I use to shave my head. And you could also support via the Buy Me a Coffee link where you get extra content. I publish stuff early sometimes. I sometimes do like just a little update video and that sort of thing. So thanks a lot. This is a great interview with Frank. We had a fun time chatting and we'll just send it to the show now. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington and I'm pumped today to chat with Frank Vasquez. And I have a great intro. Frank is a mostly retired lawyer with over 30 years experience in investing and cross-examining financial and technical experts. He holds degrees in economics and engineering from the California Institute of Technology and a law degree from Georgetown University. He's been active in the FI community since 2009. He's the host of Risk Parity Radio, started back in 2020, and he's been on Choose FI, a bunch of other podcasts, and he's also done some workshops at Economy. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was at like front row listening to one of your talks. So welcome, Frank. How's it going today?
It's going well, and thank you for having me.
It was cool to meet you in Economy this last few months ago. And yeah. I was like, oh man, you listened to the show some. That's crazy. And we just went through the intro here and you're super overqualified to be on the show. So I want to get started.
You haven't got to my sense of humor yet, which is scares people away since it's kind of like a cross between Robin Williams and Mel Brooks.
Well, you're perfect for the show. So that's the Venn diagram overlap here. So there's so many things you're qualified to talk about, and I want to get into some hard-hitting stuff. So we talk about asparagus a lot. I eat it.
Yes,
way
you do.
More
every
now.
Time. Yes, every time you talk about asparagus, that's when I'm yelling at my podcast player. It's like these guys don't know what they're talking about. They're all hat and no cattle. Mm-hmm. If you're not going with the Brussels sprouts, you're not anywhere in the vegetable world. Because all you get are, you know, these weird odors. And, you know, I get production. I get cruciferous vegetables with sulfur in them, in my gut biome. There's so many things that Brussels sprouts can do for you that asparagus just doesn't touch. And so, I think you should level up here, get to the Brussels sprouts. I like to put them with like cayenne pepper on them. I like my vegetables peppered and roasted. Or you put a little bacon in there too. I know you're a cook, so yeah. You can probably think of a number of ways to prepare them. But really need to get you off this asparagus habit. It's detrimental to your long-term
olfactory. We go back and forth. We go back and forth. A lot of Brussels sprouts as well. And you're right. It's another underrated vegetable. I think, you know, you grow up, and actually we didn't even eat Brussels sprouts in my house, but like usually you think, Brussels sprouts, those are no good. But yeah, you put some bacon on there, you get a nice char. Like you got to cook them hot, right?
Yeah. The key is to cook them hot. Where it comes in for being, you know, I'm 60 years old now. As I've aged, I have learned that certain vegetables process better in my system than other ones or as they go. And one of the things I learned in my late 40s was that raw vegetables, I can't really do much anymore. I got to go with the cooked ones. And then it was a question of which ones. And the Brussels sprouts allow me to consume copious amounts of Fireball whiskey and throw it down with some Four Loko and Buzz Balls, you know. they really do, you know, just take care of anything else you put in there that you shouldn't have probably put in your stomach.
Well, the asparagus and the Brussels, they have their place on, you know, our plates. We go back and forth, but I respect Brussels.
Yeah, so we take the asparagus. We make these little Japanese steak rolls with them that are really nice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you like wrap the steak
around a couple of Brussels sprouts there. You can do that. You can wrap them around other things, but since they're the way they're shaped, it's convenient for that.
Got it. Well, I hope everyone is ready for 50 minutes of vegetable talk. It's going to be our it's going to be our new show.
Just wait till we get the to the bacon and the ham hocks.
So today we're actually talking about spending more money. And I know a lot of folks in the FI community, like my household included, we have like frugal roots and like a frugal background. We like to save money. It's hard to switch over to spending. And it's been a conversation. I think Brad at ChooseFI has been doing a really good job like talking about spending more and like having a values-based way to look at it. And one thing we're going to talk about today, and the reason why you're hopping on with us, Frank, is to get into some of the details and how we can evaluate this in a way that, again, hits the values that are important to us. So before we get into all that, just a little background in case people don't know you, highly recommend folks check out Risk Perry Radio and the, I believe that there's five episodes. It's like 1, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9. Good yeah. entry point. And then people can kind of get a foundation of what's going on. But that said, let's talk about you, your background just a little bit. I mentioned okay. professionally, very accomplished. Talk about that a little bit. And then we'll get into how you ended up doing a podcast. So what'd you do professionally?
So as you read, I was a lawyer, worked with a big law firm for about 29 years. I was actually at the same law firm for 29 years. I worked mostly in international arbitration and litigation involving foreign sovereigns and World Bank entities. So I was running all over the world, and a lot of these cases had to do with things like the Argentine debt crisis or the split between the Czech and Slovak republics, a gold mine in Uzbekistan. It took all my mental energy and my physical energy. I really developed two skills through all of that. One is I'm an expert on examining witnesses, and particularly cross-examining witnesses. I was usually the designated, I would usually be the person on our side that would cross-examine the most difficult witnesses. My wife and I teach trial practice at Georgetown. I've been doing that since 1998. I can't end up the number of years. So this is also something I'm still actively involved in terms of the teaching of it. But the other expertise I developed because of my background in economics and engineering is I was always the person that worked with the technical and financial experts. And so these were engineers, economists, people that do valuation. A lot of this stuff was really complicated, very high level, which made me very not only kind of familiar, but comfortable with financial analysis at sort of a academic level. So I'm comfortable reading academic papers and CFA manuals and all those sorts of things, because those are the people that I typically dealt with. And that's kind of what I've applied to what I've done in terms of portfolio construction and trying to simplify that down into something that a normal person could actually use, and then what my podcast is ultimately about.
Got it. Okay. And you retired about 5 years ago, which, you know, you put in 29 years, you were doing a lot of stuff. Sounds like it was relatively high stress, high stakes. So I think it's understandable. Like, it's time to step away. You're teaching.
That's yeah. great.
How'd you get into the FI community in 2009? I'm curious
this
about
is,
that.
This is Phi Club. We didn't talk about Phi Club back then. My oldest Phi friend is Jacob Lundfisker, who wrote Early Retirement Extreme. And at around that time, his board connected with his blog was like one of the few places where Phi people came. And it was really like a Phi Club that nobody talked about, because people thought it was so weird. And he was so weird at that time. And he's a physicist. So we got along famously. There were a lot of people there. We had, this is before Mr. Bunny Mustache, before J.L. Collins. We read that stuff as it came out and would talk about it there. But it was a lot more, I would say, philosophical than what we see today. Part of it was sort of hardcore anti-consumerist, either from an environmental point of view or from a moral point of view, waste not, want not. Another part of it, though, is it was libertarian. which goes back to Harry Brown's book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. So it was a very interesting collection of people. And most of those people really are not that much involved in the Phi community more, because they were that introverted and really didn't want a whole lot of other people in their lives. But I still have connections with a number of them. So for me, it's been interesting watching this evolve. And as you have said, at that time and early on in this cycle, most of the people weren't at Phi yet. And you didn't start to get a number of people who were really at financial independence until the late 20 teens, I would say. And now that there's a whole lot more people, it's sort of, well, what do we do now? Because the whole cohort, I guess is what you would call it, has been evolving, and it is at a new place now that is interesting. There's a lot of, I think, decisions and thought processes to make that there's kind of this critical mass of people at Phi, I would say, that was not there in the first place.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that other side, but it feels like, I mean, it's been, 15 plus years since a lot of the bloggers have been around. So it's, it's a long time. People come in and fall out.
Yeah.
There's a lot more people involved.
There's a lot more people, and there's a lot more. I mean, there were no campfires or anything like that. There were no conventions to go to. There were no podcasts, really. There were blogs. And I remember when Mr. Money Mustache started his, and then there was Go Curry Cracker. And a few others around those times. But the kind of the blogging era went until about 2015, 2016, 2017. And then I remember when Choose FI came out, and I contacted those guys like after their fifth episode. It's like, welcome. Finally, we have somebody that's going to make this sound like it's a normal thing to normal people. And be the emissaries of, because, frankly, we're nerdy. This is nerdy spreadsheet people who, if you don't want to talk to me about it, fine. And then I won't talk to you about it. It became much more user friendly after we got a couple podcasts going. And I'm very happy to see that development, because it's really broadened the spectrum of feeling like who this is for. And it's really nice to see that there are so many blogs and books written by people from various walks of life, different genders, different races, different everything. And so it just feels like, yes, this is for everybody. It's not just for weirdo physicist guys. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Well, we're going to go over a couple things. Well, I think I'm actually going to save some of the topics of your podcast to the end and why you started the show. We're going to talk about like why we should maybe consider spending more money and some of the philosophy behind it. So we're also going to cover a question that was sent in by a listener, which is kind of interesting. I think by the time this episode will air, the episode with David will have already been published, but basically David retired in February of 2025. He panicked and sold about one third of his portfolio. Panic might be a strong word, but he felt the volatility and felt, this in air quotes, this time is different.
He made an unplanned decision.
Yes, unplanned decision. And I was like, it'll be cool to get your opinion. He has a couple ideas behind it too. But let's move into some of the stuff that you talked about in Cincinnati. It was impactful for a lot of folks, but I'll kind of turn it over to you, because this is a great way to lay the foundation on, why we might want to spend more.
Okay. And I think where we want to start is the idea that, talking about somebody who is in some kind of career, you're working, you're on your way to Phi, and achieving Phi is a hero's journey. It's a classic hero's journey. You've got this mountain you got to climb. You have these methods of doing that. You've struggled for various things, maybe to get out of debt, maybe to make more money, all that sort of stuff. But you end up with pursuing some combination of three kinds of things, which are essentially money, power, and fame. Money is obvious, that you need enough money to be Phi. Power is something that generally comes through your career, and your identity as whatever you're doing, because usually by the time you've been working somewhere for a while, you're either leading your own little companies or you're leading your little teams, and you have some identity that goes with that. You know, for me, it's being a lawyer. The fame part is more interesting because it's more of a product of how we live now. That if you look at if you ask children what they want to be, they don't want to be like, you know, baseball player, doctor, something. They want to be YouTuber and create things on that. So that is also something that people often pursue as part of that. Now, these things are good to have, and you need to have some money, some power, which is also just autonomy. If you don't have autonomy, you don't have that amount of power. And fame originally was just fame in your community, that you have a group of friends or people that know you as a certain kind of person. And it's more was a reputational idea. Where these things tend to go off the rails, this comes from ancient Greece. It's where it comes from. It comes from Aristotle. I'll give you another reference today. There is a guy who's like a professor of happiness at Harvard. His name is Arthur Brooks. He used to be a French horn player. He used to run a think tank. But he's written a couple books. The last one's called Build the Life You Want, where he has processed and taken all of these teachings about well-being and living well and sort of repackaged them and presented them to a modern audience. And I do recommend that people start reading things like that. That's the one of the transitions you need to make here, is going from the hero's journey. You've accomplished the hero's journey by the time you get to Phi, at least that part of your hero's journey of life. But you need to start thinking about other things, well-being. And one of the things you want to do is transition from reading books about financial stuff and personal finance and things like that to starting to read books about well-being and what you really want to get out of life, these kind of bigger life questions. I say stop contemplating your, you know, spreadsheets and start contemplating life. Oddly enough, the best way to contemplate life is actually to contemplate death, which is also an ancient practice. I think it's uncomfortable in modern life for people to have to contemplate death, because there is an idea that if you went to the Last Academy, you saw a guy presenting about some guy is trying to live forever with all of these, taking his blood out and putting it back in and doing all kinds of things. That is a modern conceit that we are going to cheat death somehow. You're better off just recognizing your own mortality. And it's an ancient practice. But once you start thinking about that, then you start thinking about, well, what do I want to accomplish before that happens? And there are other good books and resources about that. One is called The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, which is written by a woman named Bronnie Ware. It's kind of a classic. Jordan Grummet's books also go into some of these kinds of things. His last one, The Purpose Code, talks about some of this stuff and the one before that. But I would say Bronnie Ware is kind of the starting point for this, because it's, if you look at what are the top 5 regrets of the dying, I always mess them up. But basically, the most important ones are sort of being able to express yourself in the way you wanted to, have been yourself. And to me, that it also includes whatever creativity you wanted to have, whether it was paint things or write things or cook things or anything like that. Another one is I didn't work so hard. I didn't spend so much time working hard, just doing things or things that other people wanted me to do or things just to make money. And then probably the most important one is, she says, spent more time with my friends, but basically had better relationships. So if you invert those, what does it tell you need to work on? You need to work on better relationships, and then also better personal expression. And then instead of, you know, working for money and things, you start working for health or doing something that is going to be better productive in that sense. So where does that come back to with respect to these? And there are actually 4 idols. We've talked about money, power, and fame. The other one is pleasure seeking, which is, you know, what happens when people go off the rails with drugs or alcohol or other things. That's really not the focus here, because that's a different problem. The problem with money, power, and fame in particular is knowing how much is enough. Because where people get stuck is you don't change your identity and you just keep pursuing this kind of money idol. Morgan Housel has talked about this recently, and he has a book that's coming out in October. It's called The Art of Spending. The Art of Spending Money, it's going to be called. He's already done previews of this. And he refers to this problem, at least among super savers, like you often have in the FI community, as frugality inertia, that you've created this habit which works so well to accumulate money, but after a certain point, it's just not serving you anymore. You know, in the worst case, you're turning into unreformed Ebenezer Scrooge, and everything is about more money. So that is something that you need to be aware of and be able to start thinking about overcoming. But the first thing to do is to define what is enough. And whether it's 25 times your expenses, like we say, is the target for you, it might be something else. But whatever it is for you, you need to figure out what that enough is. And so you have a target, because if you don't have the target, it just keeps expanding.
And I want to interrupt you here before we go on. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Good. We'll pause. It's good to get a break from my voice, so I'm glad that you're able to to give a long answer.
I do a solo podcast, so I could just go on for an hour.
So this is great. I want to dive into some of our specifics and, like, just, you know, riffing off of what you just said. You know, it's one thing to have the specific target in mind and say, all right, we get whatever, 25X, 35X, whatever, like save some amount of money. But then you have to shift gears and actually spend part of it. And like you said, we build those muscles up of frugality and, like, hey, I'm going to try to pack up my own house and then move it instead of hiring movers, which is a great investment. Like, we've done that the last couple of times. Great fucking investment. Hire movers. They, like, it saves so much time, and we're not in college anymore, right? Like, we don't need to do it ourselves, and I got a bad back, whatever. Like, so Frank, how, like, have you been able to spend? Like, were you a spender? Were you a ultra saver? Did you have to transition from saving to, okay, we're going to spare no expense on this meal or this trip or whatever?
This varies from person to person. In my circumstance, my parents ran out of money when my father turned about 80. And this is back in around 2009, 2010, when I was at that point, I was thinking, okay, we're going to be financially independent in the next decade. Yeah. So part of solving that problem was we ended up buying them a house to live in. We bought their old house and sold it and sort of stabilized their situation so they could just live there on their Social Security, and we could take care of a lot of the expenses surrounding that and those sorts of things. So I already had kind of this extra thing I knew that we were going to have to spend money on. It wasn't kind of a stretch for me on that part. There were other things that were more preferential as we get into the things you do want to spend money on, because the cure for this problem of spending money or not being able to spend money is to start thinking about, how do I spend money to improve my life, to avoid those five regrets of the dying, including the relationship thing and the thing you were talking about, like hiring movers. As you get older, same thing with cleaning out gutters or something like that. If it's a very high thing like that, if you can pay somebody to do one of the things that it has impact, this comes from a book called The Soul of Wealth by Daniel Crosby that was published last year. He's a psychologist that works in the personal finance field and works with financial advisors. But that is one of the things is this work avoidance idea that if there are things in your life that you can pay somebody else to do that are going to make your life better, even if you could do them yourself, even if you could save money doing them yourself, even if it would be not that much trouble for you, if you can offload that to somebody else, that will actually improve your well-being. In our circumstance, like, one of the things, and we had done this before, but neither my wife or me want to clean the house, and it bothers her when the house is not clean. I'm a pig. So for one of our anniversaries, I hired a house cleaner, and that was one of the best things I did. It was like, we got to keep that. At a certain point, we hired somebody to deal with the lawn. because I don't want to deal with that either. And we can afford to have that done. So there's anything that, you don't like doing is something that you should try to think about. How can I offload this so I don't need to spend time on that? Because as we say, as you're contemplating death, you only got so much life left and you don't want to be spending it doing things that chores, if you will, just to save money. And this is something one of the four things that Daniel Crosby said, yeah, that's a target. That's a target. Sit down and say at the beginning of the year, instead of thinking of New Year's resolutions of what are the things I should start doing, what are the things I should stop doing and have and pay somebody else to do? It's a good exercise to go through. And sit down with your spouse, because this is also a way to relieve conflicts between the two of you, as it was in our circumstance. For us, it's also when we travel, I don't care where I sleep. And in fact, if it's weird, if I could go sleep in the giant watermelon or the roadside attraction, those are the kind of places I like to go, just the novelty and the entertainment value of it. That's appalling to my wife. She hates that stuff. She wants to have a certain level of comfort. And so it's very good for our relationship, which is the primary thing you want to spend money on, as well as this kind of avoidance of problems, to think about how can I spend money on something? It's not necessary, but it's going to actually make something better in our life, and it be appreciated in her case. Mm-hmm. Because that's ultimately where the most important thing to really think about is, how can I spend more money on relationships to improve my relationships? The first thing you need to do there is really take an inventory of your relationships, because you may have a lot of money, but you may be kind of poor in relationships. This is a big problem for men in our country, that all their relationships are in their job. And so to the extent they have relationships outside of that, it's through their spouse. They're kind of relationship poor, and that you need to build that out, if you will. And you need to be willing to exchange money for that. For instance, in our Phi community, now you can go attend Camp Phi's or economies or other things and find other people that will cost you some money. You can go to your local groups. You can meet up with other people. You can get involved in pickleball or other activities. And that is one way to start cultivating those relationships. But before you do that, you start with your, assuming you have a good marriage, you want to start with that. That is a gift, because not everybody has a good marriage or even has a spouse around anymore. People start dying in their 40s. The other thing you should look to that was particularly important to me was, I have some friends I grew up with. I grew up in Iowa, but I live in Virginia. But in order for me to continue those relationships and not it just be like on social media or something, you know, I got to get off my butt and go visit them in Chicago and the other places where we gather. And maintaining those relationships often is a good reason for you to be traveling back to somewhere to do something with somebody who's important to you. And maybe you need to go try and recultivate those things, particularly if you're Phi and your friend is not, and they can't travel much. Maybe you should just go see them. But all of these things are, if you're really intentional about this, is if you really sit down and say, okay, these are my important relationships. How can I spend money to improve these relationships, either through, hopefully through some kind of activity together or gathering, but also maybe some people just need to be given a gift of something that can be another thing. For instance, my wife likes to get flowers every week, so I go get her flowers every week. Is it necessary? It's not very expensive, but it's a nice gesture, and it's something that she's said, this is what I'd like you to do. I do it. I get the points. Everybody's happy. The money gets spent. A lot of things are like that with respect to relationships, either promoting them or reducing that friction by being willing to say, spend more money on a certain kind of travel. My wife likes to stay places where there are kitchens. She likes to cook. It's a priority to me I'm usually the person planning on where to stay, as to finding things that I think she'll like a little kitchen or a kitchenette. She'll like a gym. She wants to have a gym there in the place we stay. Those sorts of, being aware of what the preferences are of the other person in that relationship and then meeting those preferences or surprising them with something, regardless of how much more it may cost, or you can't use your points in that place or whatever, you need to put those, you need to put those priorities aside, that the priority is not getting the best deal, using the points the way you want to, or any of those sorts of things. You need to shift that priority to pleasing whomever you're with, assuming that that person is a relationship you want to cultivate.
Yeah, there's a couple things I want to go back to. And one is the relationships that men have with their friends. And it's really easy for us to like push it off. Or like you said, social media makes it a little too easy and also like impersonal. And like, I actually was texting, we're behind on this, but some friends from college, like we, I think the last time we saw each other was like 5-6 years ago, which is a little too long. So like, we're trying to get it back together. And like, I mean, it's been long enough. One of the guys, he was like, I have a new phone number. Like it came through another person. I was like, shit. Like, I feel bad, but yeah, like everyone's a little busy and like, it's easy to just like not, I mean, it's hard. You got to like keep up the relationship and there's no replacement for like going to a place where nobody is familiar. And then you're all there together. Hopefully you throw your fucking phones in the other place, so no one's distracted by their phone. No one's working and you're just spending like idle time, like college days, you know, it was a different time 30 years ago. But it's like you hang out, you tell stories, whatever, play cards, like hike, whatever you do.
You did whenever you were friends. My oldest friend is somebody I've known since I was 3. And most of that group is from high school. But so for instance, and you have to go do things that you probably wouldn't ordinarily do or pay for. So one of my friends is a big Chicago Cubs fan. This is the oldest one. And what he likes to do every year is go to a different city where the Cubs are playing and go to a different baseball stadium and see the games there. And so, you know, he plans this every year and asks who can go. So I make a point to make sure that I'm going to that activity. This time we're going to New York to see them play in Yankee Stadium. And we rented an Airbnb in the middle of Manhattan, and it's very expensive, but we all want to have one place where we can gather and sit and play board games or cards or other things when we're not going to these games. But the activity itself is meaningless. I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely meaningless. I went to New York all the time for work, and it was no, I have no reason to go there other than some kind of event like this. But the idea that if you have a friend that is planning these sorts of things or is the one who wants to do that, you need to step up and say, yeah, I'm in, because that will get other people to come in. And if you don't have a friend that's doing that, maybe you need to be the one that does it. It's not going to happen without you being willing to step up and also you being willing to spend the money on it. You're not planning it so it's the cheapest way possible, the most convenient way possible for the most people involved that you care about, even if it's going to cost more than you think it ought to or it should. It's just a matter of prioritizing that I'm going to go to things even if it's crowded, expensive, inconvenient, because the relationship and keeping the relationship is important. And it's easy to say that, oh, well, I'll just miss it this time. It's like, well, there aren't going to be that many more times, you know?
Right.
If I see this group of friends for the next 20 years, and I'm 80 years old, that's only 20 times.
Yeah.
And so each one of those things is an opportunity to continue a relationship. And those, if you have those old relationships, I mean, I'm so lucky. That's a gift also, if you are a man who has relationships that date back that far, that you're still friends with people from your childhood. Most men don't have that anymore.
Right.
And it's hard.
And I'll riff on this one more time, because I don't think people talk about it that much. Shout out to Brad Barrett, Choose FI. He put together a trip with, I think it was like 8-ish guys. And some of us knew each other, some didn't. And it was really cool. Several days out in Breckenridge. awesome relationships were formed, like new friends. Not everybody hit it off like 100% completely where we're like calling each other all the time, but everyone was cool. You know, I think Brad like vetted some folk. but the thing is like, you can, I mean, he didn't kick anybody out, you know, but like he knew who he was inviting. Everyone was cool.
He just didn't tell those people.
And yeah, basically like we can make new friends, but you have to put the time in. And like when we were young, when we were in college and we had like all the time in the world and we were, you know, idiots, but now it's like, okay, like there's a very clear opportunity cost, whether it's with your immediate family, other people that you already have relationships with. So there's like some skin in the game if you're like going off for several days to hang out with like new friends to hope that you're going to build some relationship. Do you have any comments on that?
There are basically four things you can spend money on to make your life better that have been identified by Daniel Crosby and others. It's relationships, experiences, the work avoidance, which we've already talked about, and then giving money away. So this, what you're talking about now, I think goes more to experiences, because experiences, there are two things you're getting out of experiences. One is what we're not talking about here, which is just something you like doing. You like painting, you like cooking, I like riding my bike, that you just get pleasure out of, or you get into a flow state when you're doing it, the creativity side of things. But then there's also a part of this that goes to this relationship thing. And what Brad was doing was getting together people as acquaintances, because one of my goals in later life has been to make new friends. In order to make new friends, first you have to make new acquaintances. And so you have to get out there. You have to go to these events, these people that you don't know or you know a little. And it isn't going to be we climb this mountain and then we're friends. It's friendships happen more when you were young. You were just hanging out with the people all the time. It kind of developed through that. Later in life, I found it is more having first acquaintances and then somebody has a problem and you become the person that comes in to help them, that you step up to help them. And that is really where the friendship starts, the real friendship. I'll give you a couple of examples. For me, one of my best friends in Thailand is Diana Merriam. The reason we are friends is because I listened to her on various things and she talked about walking the Camino, and I thought we want to do that sometime. So I'd send her some emails and so we became acquaintances that way. And then she sent me some materials and it went back and forth. After she ran her first economy, this was like one of her kind of lifelong dreams. And it went okay as far as the event was concerned, but financially it was a disaster. She lost $40,000. And she was wondering, can I continue this? And she reached out to a few people, and I was one of those people, but because she was like, I gotta get help. I gotta do something. And she also wanted people to look at her finances to see whether she was going to be okay, because she was either had just left work or was leaving work at the time. And so I was one of those people that she contacted. I said, well, you can't lose $40,000 every year, but you can. She says, I can figure that out. But she was like, I don't know how to do social media, and we need to invite people to do other things. And I said, well, I don't know how to do promotional social media either. She erroneously thought that I did. but I said, but I know how to teach things, and I will come and teach something, a breakout session at your next economy, so you can just kind of fill that slot and we'll do something and that'll help you. It was that stepping up, getting in there to solve a problem that really like cemented our friendship. And it's, you know, why when she got married last year, Mary and I went to her wedding. That's how acquaintances turn into friendships. There's one from your community. I'm not revealing any personal secrets here because both these people have talked about it. Mark Trautman's wife died a few years back. And I know he went to, I think, a Camp Fi, and Jordan Grumman happened to be there, who was the hospice doctor. And Mark has said that was very comforting that they knew each other, but there was a connection that was formed, a friendship that was formed. But in order for you to be able to do that, first you have to spend the money and go and have these acquaintance kind of things where you're just hanging out with people And usually it's around some activity, either you're hiking, or maybe you're skiing, or maybe you're biking, or you're playing pickleball, or whatever kind of activity you kind of like doing, and go find some people that do that. And that will at least start you on the acquaintances that turn into friendships. But when you're doing that, make sure that you're willing to spend the money to do it. Don't, if you got to buy a certain kind of equipment to participate in that, go spend the money on it.
Right.
You're not spending money on the equipment. You're spending money on potential relationships and new friendships. And that's the way you need to start thinking about it. That everything you do, what I always run through my head when I'm thinking of options of stuff to do, I'm always thinking of, well, how is this going to make a relationship better? So, for instance, I won't travel anymore just to travel. I'll only go if there's a relationship involved, whether it's going to New York with my friends or traveling with my wife somewhere. Or this fall, we are going to South Africa with Bill Yount and his wife. It was their suggestion to go to South Africa. We talked about going to Spain, and we said, yes, it will be a very nice trip. It'll be very fun. It's a very expensive, you know, people taking right. you around to safaris and all that sort of stuff. But I would not have done that trip unless there was a relationships involved at this stage of my life. And that's what I think you want to think about prioritizing things. That, yes, you want to do some things just because you like doing them and it's a creative thing, but other priorities should be done on the basis of, is this going to either improve an old relationship or potentially start a new one?
Got it. That's how I've justified the last 4 guitar purchases. Like, oh yeah, this is definitely, I'll have to tell my wife, you know, I need to reframe it a little bit, but okay. So it's hard to cram all of the like info into, you know, this episode. So I do want to transition over to the email and some of your thoughts on David's situation, but any sort of last thoughts on like what we're spending money on, the idols, any other values that we need to think about here?
There is kind of a danger that I don't think is really appreciated in Phi communities right now. And it's this idea that you become the 5 people you spend the most time with. And so if all of the people you spend time with are sitting around ruminating about money and looking at their spreadsheets and charts and things like that, that may not be that healthy for you. And you may need some friends outside of the Phi community or to recognize that you are inadvertently reinforcing these no spending habits or this frugality inertia, as Morgan Housel says. I don't think enough people are conscious of that, but I see that going on because I listen to so many Phi podcasts that it seems like this kind of virus that gets hold of a community and all of a sudden they're all talking about, you know, 3% or 2% safe withdrawal rates, and it's just sinking into some kind of a morass. You need to be conscious of that's not happening and getting out of it or removing yourself from that if hanging out with those people too much is causing you to ruminate about it. Then the other thing we didn't talk about was giving, as far as one of the things that will improve your life overall is spending your money. And this is there are basically 3 ways. One is advances on inheritances, that there's no reason and it's not very good financial planning to be hoarding all your money and not giving it to your heirs until you're dead and they're probably 60 years old and they don't need it anyway. You need to figure out a way to start transferring wealth to your kids or whomever sometime earlier in life in some kind of reasonable way, either funding IRAs or helping them with houses or what, however you want to do it. The mechanism is not important. Just the idea, though, that sitting on it with the idea that they're going to love you more if they get this big chunk of change when later in life, actually that tends to backfire, believe it or not. There's a lot of research on this too. You can also support charities themselves. I suggest that you get involved with whatever that is. So for me, I work with a charity called the Father McKenna Center that supports hungry and homeless people in Washington, D.C. And I'm on the board and I'm the treasurer and I promote this heavily on my podcast. And so it's also building relationships with a different group of people. most of these board members are older than me. I'm the little kid. I'm the young guy. it's great. But it also gives you, it's like, these people are like, you know, they're 80 some years old and they're very active and they're, you know, loving life. And it's like, yeah, that's what I want to be. I better figure that out and learn something from these people. And then you might just find other random things to give to or people to help. Right. Whether they're in your family or not, like for me, it's, you know, my parents, and but there might be other just people that need help that you can just swoop in there and save them from something. Mm-hmm. Because that's another, and be thinking about that if I had a goal for the FI community, it would be that everybody start, once they reach FI and don't have any financial issues, that you start spending 1% annually of your accumulated wealth on some kind of charitable, giving it away somehow, whether it's mm-hmm. your family or a charity or something else. But I think, to me, that's a good goal to have, because it has greatly improved my outlook on life, that I'm participating and doing good things in the world and not just sitting there worried about what's going to happen in 30 years when I'm probably going to be dead anyway.
Right. Yeah. And I'll give another, I haven't developed that skill of like the specific charitable giving monetarily, but I have been volunteering for the last couple of years, which, I mean, I think, you know, time is such a precious resource. Like, I think actually spending the time and spending it with people instead of just like writing a check. So I'm a mentor for a startup accelerator for underrepresented communities, roughly in the area here. It's called E4All, so people could look it up. But, you know, that has been very rewarding, and it's, you know, it's an hour per week for a quarter, and I keep signing up and doing it because it is rewarding. It's literally helping small businesses like try to get started. They have a lot of skin in the game. They're putting in a ton of work, but way more valuable to spend the time versus like writing a $1,000 check or whatever the monetary equivalent.
So when one of them is starting up a band, I mean, you can give them one of your guitars.
That's right.
We're going to set you up here. You know, that's those sort of little random acts of kindness or gifts are often kind of the best things, that you may meet somebody that they need something and you're like, oh yeah, I got one of those, or I don't mind giving you this. Those things are surprisingly, they get more bang for your buck than you think. And I suppose the one other thing that I'd given you this before we started, but one thing that I think really you want to focus on is, what people always focus on, what is my probability of running out of money for the rest of my life? I think you need to compare that with, what is the probability of you dying in the next 10 years? Because it's a lot more than you think it is. by the time you get to be, you're 45? So yeah, your expected mortality rate in the next 10 years is 5.3%.
It's higher than I thought, yeah.
Yes, it is higher than you thought. It's later than you thought in terms of mm-hmm. the time you have left. And so if your probability of running out of money in the next 30 years is less than, it's like 0.5%, that tells you your priorities are kind of messed up. That you could be loosening up on some of the purse strings. But I think just realizing that, I've known enough people that have, you know, died young, either, you know, it's always a random thing. My niece's fiance, you know, 40, and he faints one day, goes to the doctor. You have a glioblastoma, you're going to die in 18 months. I had a brother who had a stroke at age 58. There's a famous financial writer, Jonathan Clements, you know, who was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer recently, and he's got months left to live. It's unlikely you were going to live this long age and then have 10 years of long-term care or something like that. What's going to happen is it's going to go bang, or there's going to be a short illness and you don't know when it's coming. So I think you really need to be mindful that you don't have as much time as you think you do. You have a lot more money than you think you do. I'm just putting that in perspective.
You sent this PDF and chart. Am I able to share that with other folks? Did you create this from data from somewhere?
Yeah, ChatGPT.
Okay, great. All right.
It actually comes from the Social Security Administration.
It's clean data. It's clean data. But yeah, we'll share it so people can take a look. So have a look at the show notes. And let's go to David's situation here. David reached a point between Coast Fi and Full Fi. He decided to leave his job for essentially a long-term sabbatical. His wife still has a job, and he retired the end of February 2025, right before a lot of volatility. If we remember, this was during a talk of tariffs, and it was uncertain. So David felt like things were a little bit different than normal and different than the last time. He sold about a third of his portfolio when the market bottomed out, like literally that day when it dropped, and then it resumed, it jumped back up. So he actually has a good perspective on this, and I'll mention these four different perspectives that he has. So he says it could be an expensive but worthy insurance policy against a recession or downturn. Number two, it could be money spent on a degree of independence from the market, sort of a cash cushion. Number three, a wise diversification that he should have done a while back. He says here that he was about 90% U.S. stocks, which is pretty heavy, especially for somebody approaching retirement. Typically, you would see a de-risk situation. And then number four, he says it could be a total screw up based on attempting to time the market. So Frank, what do you think is someone who is, I guess you're very knowledgeable about portfolio design and some of the situations here. So what do you think?
He needed a better plan to begin with. What he should first do is go back and does he still have enough money to be financially independent right now? Is that a problem? Because what we don't know from this is how much of his money is he really spending?
So I did talk to him. I think he does need to sell a little bit. So it was only one third of his portfolio. And so that's kind of softened the blow a little bit. And basically, I think he needs to sell a little bit because his wife doesn't cover all their expenses. But I didn't ask for specific percentages or amounts, but I think it's a relatively small amount. So he's still okay. He's on sabbatical. Yeah. He's not planning on going back to work for long term. His kids are like 1 in 5. So he's cool, but it's just like stings a little.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in that case, it's just stinging a little because I mean, the truth is if you are spending 3% or less of your accumulated assets on an annual basis, you can hold just about anything. You can hold 90% stocks. That's what I would call the Warren Buffett portfolio, the 90% S&P 500 and 10% T-bills. The reason you can hold something like that is because you're not spending that much money. Don't spend money always works, but it's not exactly ideal for the rest of your life because it implies that your main goal in life is to accumulate the most money at death. Which when you tell people that, it's like, no, that's not what I mean. It's like, well, when are you going to spend it? With him, if he's got young kids, that is a whole different conversation as to what his spending is. His spending is likely of the family is likely to peak when the kids are high school or college. That's the typical spending pattern of families. So it's just a mistake right now. But the question it then becomes, how do we want to fix this? Because what I deal with, what I'm trying to do on my podcast is to create portfolios that have the highest safe withdrawal rates. So I'm spending at a 5% annualized rate. And that's my goal, is to have a portfolio that supports that. If you are not spending that much money, you don't need to have a more complicated portfolio. And maybe for them, if he's willing to keep riding that pony, he could stick with a very large portfolio allocation to equities. If you are trying to spend, I mean, that's really what I call a fear and greed portfolio. And this is exactly what happens. You're going, oh, I can handle it. That's greed speaking. Things are going great. I can handle this. No problem. And then something happens and the fear sets in. And the fact that if you're vacillating between fear and greed like that is what it's telling you is your position is probably too aggressive for your mental health, basically, if nothing else. I think he should, we know going back to Bill Bengen, his original research, that a retirement portfolio designed for spending money, that 4% rule portfolio, has between 40 and 70% in stocks, or up to 75% now. If you have more than that in stocks, that is not really a drawing down portfolio, because that portfolio has a lower safe withdrawal rate than 4%. In fact, if you are 100% stocks, your safe withdrawal rate on that, with those metrics or that analysis, is more like 3.5 or 3.3. So it's really, he does not have a portfolio that is designed for drawing upon. Whether he really needs one or not, that has more to do with the expense side of things. I mean, is his wife going to retire soon is another question. Or when is he really going to start living on this money? Because although he's retired, as a financial unit, it doesn't sound like they are retired in terms of needing to live off the money. In which case, if that's not going to happen for another 10 or 15 years, yeah, you could just keep it in mostly equities or all equities, but you got to leave it alone. Right. you got to leave it alone if you're doing that. You can't, got to recognize that we don't need this. We actually don't need this money right now. It's like we're still accumulating because my wife is working and that's covering the bills. He's not really in a drawdown scenario. He's in a still accumulating scenario. Mm-hmm. So he's got that option, but he needs to decide which one it is.
Right.
If he does want to move to something that is designed for drawing out of, the first thing you need to recognize is that piles of cash actually don't help you that much. That part of Bill Bengen's original research was, if you are doing a retirement portfolio and you have more than 10% in cash in it, it will drag down on the safe withdrawal rate. More than 10% in cash is a drag. And I don't care how you arrange it. People talk about bucket strategies and ladders and flower pots and all sorts of complicated. These are band-aids that people put on a portfolio that's really not designed for retirement.
It's psychological, right? It's like,
yes. Yeah, it's a psychological thing. It works. That was its original intention by the person that invented it, is to keep people from messing with their real portfolio by giving them this pile of cash that they can just spend and they won't be selling out like this. It doesn't actually help you in terms of,
right,
of the math of it, because the other myth or misnomer that is going around that I'm afraid is all too common. Too many people believe this, that by having like 3 years of cash or a bucket that lasts for 3 years, that solves your sequence of return risk. That does not solve your sequence of return risk.
Shoot, I just said it in the live stream. I said something similar to that, but that was the spirit of it. So where did I fuck it up then?
Okay, so the safe withdrawal rate is based on worst case scenarios. It's not based on average case scenarios. So it's not based on an average downturn.
I got you.
The worst case scenarios are a 10-year. It's a bad decade. That is the problem you need to solve sequence of return risk. Solving a 3-year problem or a 2-year problem or a 5-year problem, you are not solving sequence of return risk. So don't disabuse yourself because any portfolio could survive a 3-year downturn or anything we've seen in the past 15 years.
Right.
If you want to stress test your portfolio with the most recent really bad period, you need to pretend that you're retiring at the end of 1999. Mm-hmm. In your lifetimes, that's the worst period. In my lifetime, the late 60s is the worst period. At a minimum, when you're thinking about this, you stress test at the worst times. That is the worst time in most people's lifetime these days. And that will at least tell you whether whatever you're doing, how would it have played out if you did it in that scenario? And you can just put it in a calculator, like on Portfolio Visualizer, and say, mm-hmm, take out 4% every year and what happened to this, you know, in 10 years or 20 years.
Right.
So in order to solve that problem, you cannot solve that with cash. You cannot solve that with buckets. Mm-hmm. You need to solve it by diversifying the main part of the portfolio.
This is where the Bitcoin comes in, right?
You're hoping.
It's kind of, yeah. I mean, a bucket of Bitcoin. That's what
they did. There are some general guidelines as to the kinds of portfolios that end up yielding the highest safe withdrawal rates. And they start with these two Bengen ideas, one being it's sort of between 40 and 70% in equities or 40 and 75%. Bengen likes 55%. He's got a book coming out in August that says 55%. But then in terms of the stocks themselves, those need to be diversified out of just a total market fund or a two fund thing that's just domestic and international. It's all large cap. The easiest way to split that is simply half growth and half value. And it doesn't need to necessarily need to be small cap value. It could just be large cap value. You could have a large cap growth fund and a large cap value fund that have the exact same things in it that a S&P 500 fund does in it. But if you have them in two pots and then you can rebalance them over time, it will perform better. It will make your safe withdrawal rate higher. But then the next thing you need is bonds. They should be treasury bonds. No corporate bonds, no total bond funds that have corporate bonds in them, just treasury bonds. They have nice cheap funds at Vanguard now. You can get them all and you can get the short ones, you can get the intermediate ones, you can get the long ones. Essentially, it's somewhere between 15% and 30% in intermediate and long-term treasury bonds is what goes in there. The sole purpose of that allocation is recession insurance. There's nothing to do with a yield on it. It's just sitting there. So when 2020 comes or 2008 comes or the early 2000s come, when everything's just crashing because there's a recession and everybody's unemployed, that will go up by 10, 15, 20%. And then you'll sell some of it and buy the stocks when they're, you'll sell high, buy low. And people get confused or try to make this more complicated. You're not buying bonds for their returns. That's why you have stocks. Stocks are driving the bus. That's your engine. Bonds are like brakes. It's a mistake to go looking at yields and doing complicated things with corporate bonds or other things. And so if you do those two sorts of things, you'll get a portfolio that looks like what you'll see in Bengen's new book. Okay. He makes it more complicated on the stock side. That portfolio has a safe withdrawal rate of 4.7%. Then if you want it to be higher, then if you want to go over 5% on just the, and I'm talking about the original assumptions, 30 years, adding inflation every year, neither one of those things is applicable. And we can talk about what's more realistic than that. But the other thing that makes this work is alternative assets. It's between 10 and 25% in those. Gold is usually the classic. A lot of studies now showing the easiest one to read is Early Retirement Now, Karsten's blog, Safe Withdrawal Rate series number 34. If you read that, he thought the gold wouldn't have an effect on safe withdrawal rate. And so he did this study going back 100 years and determined that actually it did, that if you added 10 to 15% in gold in a portfolio, and not coins, not chains, buy an ETF. Do everything in ETFs. Don't mess around with anything else. If you put 10 to 15% of gold in a portfolio that's otherwise stocks and bonds, it's going to improve the safe withdrawal rate.
You say number 34 in
number 34 safe withdrawal rate series number 34 is the article. There are many more studies like that. People don't want to believe that or like to know that. That's an American thing. You know that you talk to investors outside the United States. It's like, of course we have gold. Everybody has gold. What are you talking about? it's odd because again, you're not holding that because you think it's going to have giant returns, even though it actually has had giant returns recently. But that it basically sits there and then goes up a whole bunch in a period of time when. Like now, when there's geopolitical things going on and tariffs and things like that, everybody's like, we don't want to buy anything. And this is a very international asset. So it the demand comes from outside the U.S. mostly. It's like the Chinese central bank and other people. And that's why the price goes up. So, I've held that for 10 years, but now I'm selling it. I've been selling gold for the past year and a half because it's done the best. And what you do is you sell the thing that's doing the best is the way that works. So if you do those four things or five things, however you want to call it, the stock allocation, the bond allocation, make sure you diversify the stocks into at least growth and value. You can have international ones or not, or all sorts of other things there, however you want to do that. Add 10 to 25% in alternative assets and less than 10% in cash. Those kind of portfolios have historically had safe withdrawal rates in excess of 5%.
David has something to go off of, but really the last several minutes, you've kind of been covering what you talk about on your podcast. It's all about risk parity, right?
It's all about you. And in this context, risk parity refers to what is called Ray Dalio's Holy Grail principle, which ultimately means you focus first on diversification of your assets and not on, say, the macro allocations of how many stocks and how many bonds. And you do not focus on simplicity as the simplicity is the third level. So, and this goes contrary to what you hear in a lot of personal finance circle, that simplicity is the most important. Actually, simplicity is not the most important thing. It's the thing you use to make sure that you're not having 10 or 15 things and you can have 5 or 6 things to deal with. The real rule of simplicity should be what Einstein said about it. Make it as simple as possible, but no simpler. So don't get obsessed with having 1, 2, or 3 things in a portfolio. That is not going to help you have a better drawdown scenario or help you with that.
And for a simple mind like mine, the simple plans do. I like the, you know, just a couple few things, but you know, I understand.
Well, this is the thing. I think people get hung up on this, but at the same time, which is one of the oddest things, in the other parts of their financial life, they're doing all kinds of weird, complicated things. They, you know, they're running these real estate empires and they have this entrepreneurial thing and this business over here with these advertising and these revenue streams and they're, you know, they have a giant spreadsheet with all of these travel hacking things going on in it. What I'm talking about is actually simpler than any of that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
In the end, it's just, let's have 5 or 6 things. Let's rebalance them once a year. Then let's, you know, take from the ones that are doing the best when it's time to take money out of it. The right. End.
That is simple. Well, okay. So we got to wrap for now. Frank, it's been awesome. I think, you know, we should pencil in to hit 2.0 topics sometime in the future here.
Yeah.
I've been checking out your show. I went through the early episodes, like when we did the pre-interview. I was like, there's a lot of episodes. There's over 400 some odd episodes, right?
429 today.
And I was like, where to start? So hit those odd numbered single digit episodes. They lay the foundation. And a lot of times it's like email questions, right? Is that kind of the
jam? Yeah. See, what this has evolved into, I call it a dive bar of personal finance and do-it-yourself investing, because it is kind of like a same group of people. I have like 2,000 listeners, but there's a core group. So it's like going into Cheers and seeing the same people over and over again. And I have a lot of repeat listeners and people asking follow-up questions. So like I'm answering a question today from somebody that put together a portfolio 2 years ago and has been retired since then. And so there's a lot of that kind of follow-up questions, which is why it's kind of difficult to just come in at the end. And these questions are all over the place. People ask me whatever's on their mind. They ask me about direct indexing. Somebody just sent me a question about Bitcoin in a portfolio. Somebody sent me a question about an ETF called Box, BOXX. Sometimes people ask me about going to law school. But it's one of those places. It's like, because people will go like, hey, check this out. Have you seen this? What do you think? You know. So it's easier because the first episodes I didn't have any audience, so I was actually trying to just explain things and build things. And those 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9 are the foundational episodes. If you want to hear something funny, listen to episode 400, which I took those 5 episodes, fed them into an AI and had it create a new AI podcast with 2 people.
That's great. Very good.
All in one place. There is an RSS feed page or link where all of the podcasts are on one big web page. And that is how people find particular topics, because there we have like episodes about transitioning. Mm-hmm. A lot of people ask questions about transitioning. A lot of people ask questions about, well, how do I, if I'm kind of match expenses with my assets and liabilities? These questions come up repeatedly. If you go there and you can word search it, like the word transition, and then you'll see those sorts of things. There's a history of FI episode. I think it's episode 276, but don't quote me on that. Could be 294.
Very good. Well, we'll link up to it so people could find the show easily. And of course, like you said, they can do the search feature. There's an easy way that you could send Frank a question. So if you're like, oh, I want to follow up, you can go head over there and ask the question and maybe you'll be featured sometime in the future. I understand there's a very, very long list of questions. So it's a long wait.
Yeah, it's a 2 month wait if you just ask the question, but you can go to the front of the line by donating to the charity that I support, the Father McKenna Center. And if you listen to the last few episodes, we are actually running a matching campaign. One of my listeners who wishes to remain anonymous put up $15,000 as matching money. And so starting last week, I've been asking people to put in donations to match. And so now all of the emails I'm answering now are people that have donated. And I think that's going to go on for some period of time, but that's how you get to go to the front of the line. It's funny. One of the people that sent me a question was Tim Joyner, Gwen's husband. Gwen's a good friend of mine, so I had to insert some funny things with South Park Timmy in there. Timmy! Classic. Yeah, the thing you have to tolerate about my podcast is you have to deal with my sense of humor, which involves lots of sound clips and goofiness and other things that it really is like listening to Robin Williams and Mel Brooks talk about personal finance sometimes.
All the numbers can get kind of dry. So like you need the comic relief, I believe. So Frank, this has been awesome. It's good to have gotten to know you a little better through like last couple events and then chatting now. Really appreciate it. And like I said, we'll link up so people can connect with you and check out your show. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm around.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. All right, Frank. I was doing some stuff with my like credit report and all that stuff a little while back. I think I was getting a credit card for the points. So I like froze my credit a little while back. So I had to unfreeze it. I had to thaw my credit out, which was a relatively straightforward process. One funny thing, I ended up like taking a look at my credit report and I think it was Equifax. They still think that I work at Applebee's and that I've worked at Applebee's for the last 26 years. I'm curious, do you freeze your credit? Do you take a look at the reports? How involved are you with like that kind of admin stuff over there?
Yeah, I have frozen my credit reports. It's interesting. I just had an experience like that too. It makes a good excuse when you go somewhere. I was buying some tires recently and they were like, do you want to sign up for our credit card? And I was like, well, my credit, it's all frozen, so I can't sign up for anything. So basically, I was able to get the discount without having to sign up for their program because they ran it through and it bounced. And I said, I told you it's going to bounce.
That's nice.
So I saved 10% without having to deal with the Tires Plus credit card or whatever it was, which I was like, yeah, I'll do that all the time. But my problem is I haven't applied for credits in so long that I'm not sure I remember how to unfreeze it.
Yeah.
I can figure it out, but
yeah. Well, that said, it sounds like you don't worry about the credit card points game or anything like that. You don't pay attention.
Oh, I have enough cards and I accumulate points on them, but no, I am not buying more cards and getting more points. I have a fun card that pays me back in Bitcoin.
Oh, really?
Up to 4% for gas.
Interesting.
So it's that has a lot of entertainment value.
Yeah. How much is that paid back over time? Like with the, I mean, how long have you had it? Interesting.
I've had it for a few years. So I had it through the last trough. So I've been paid back like $1,800, but it's worth like $5,800 now.
Whoa.
Because I haven't done anything with it. That's my Bitcoin, you know?
Right. Interesting. So you have a strong position in Bitcoin.
A $5,000 for credit card points.
Yeah. Is it hard for you to get those out? Like, do you have to pay fees or anything weird? Or can you?
No,
like,
I could. What I would do is just cash them in to pay the credit card off itself.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I use it all the time. I mean, I wouldn't take it out or move Bitcoin from one place to another. I don't think it makes any sense anymore. If you want to invest in Bitcoin, just buy one of the ETFs these days. All the providers have them. So that's the only other Bitcoin I've owned is through ETFs.
Gotcha. A few years ago when it was so hot, we interviewed one of our acquaintances locally here, and it was shortly before like a lot of stuff dropped out. It must have been 2022 or so. And literally, like after we recorded, within a week, shit hit the fan and he was like, I probably shouldn't release it. And we were like, yeah, like we can't release this anymore. Like everything you said is like no longer valid. But it was around that a couple months beforehand. I put a small amount. I think I put in like $5,000 or so. And I was like, I'm going to leave it in for many years. So it was a long-term thing. And I think it's doubled. Like at this point.
Yeah. And I think
long way to get there.
But that mentally, that's actually a very good way of dealing with these speculative assets that come along and you're wondering, gosh, should I get in there or do something like that? Oftentimes just owning a little of it so you can say, oh yeah, I have some of that. When your Bitcoin enthusiast friend is like, you got to get in on this. Oh yeah, I have like, some of that.
Good.
I end up with this pile of junk, actually, sort of.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Of random things. And so, I mean, and usually there's something in there that does really well, but most of it just kind of, doesn't do much of anything.
And I think what I'm going to do, the other good part is I've like kind of predetermined, like I have a decision, at least a blueprint around 2029. I think I'll probably sell it then and just move on. And hopefully it'll be, you know, a few times whatever I put in. I could, whatever, go on a trip or buy a nice guitar or something like that. But I'm like, okay, kind of predetermined. Maybe I'll let it ride longer, but I'm not going to freak out or anything. So, okay. Very good.
Well, I usually get a question about every 6 months about Bitcoin in a portfolio to my podcast, and I just got one yesterday. So,
yeah.
But it has changed over time. I can tell you that the volatility is different, the exposures are different.
Right.
It is interesting watching it evolve. But they always ask me, "What do you think it's going to go?" It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, no clue.